Welcome to Session 10 of Mind in the Cosmos. In this session, we'll take an overview of all the sessions and topics and material we've covered so far. We'll recap what we covered throughout the course, trying to tie up loose ends and connecting back into the key themes and topics covered along the way. For example, how are our philosophical worldviews or stories, how do they impact the world we live in? We will summarize the four different mind-body worldviews and question the appropriateness of energy talk when exploring consciousness. We will evaluate the potential for quantum physics to enlighten us about consciousness and acknowledge and discern different ways of knowing. We will decide whether we want our study of consciousness to lead to truth, or to wisdom, or to both. And we will clarify what we mean by mind in the cosmos, or the cosmic eye. We began this course by looking at the impact our stories have on the world around us, particularly stories about the cosmos and how we fit into nature. We saw that the dominant story of cosmology describes a universe beginning with a Big Bang about 15 billion years ago, or more recently they've narrowed it down to 13.7 billion years, a universe that had not the slightest trace of mind or consciousness to begin with. In other words, the standard story tells us we live in a universe made up of utterly objective physical stuff, a universe composed of dead matter or energy. Mind or cosmos, so this story goes, emerged in the universe much, much later, perhaps as recently as only a couple of million years ago, when human nervous systems and brains evolved. So mind, according to this story, is a mysterious product of complex brains. Somehow, we are told, the immense complexity of matter found in brains is sufficient to produce the interior cosmos of the mind. The rest of nature, perhaps extending to the rest of the entire cosmos, continues to be utterly mindless, without any intelligence, purpose, meaning, or value other than whatever human brains contribute and project. The only mind in the cosmos, then, belongs to humans. Some versions of this dominant cosmology story do allow for the possibility that a few other animal species, such as whales, dolphins, elephants, chimpanzees, gorillas, and perhaps dogs and cats and some birds, do have consciousness. But in all cases, only those creatures with highly evolved brains could possess consciousness. And this is a very brain-centric story, a story that excludes the rest of the cosmos from participating in the community of consciousness. And as we saw, it is also a highly human-centric story that places human minds and human brains and intelligence above the rest of nature. In fact, as I emphasized, it is a story whose central motif is the assumption that humans are special. This idea of human specialness, we saw, is common to both science and religion. We are special, they say, because we have consciousness and are souls. We saw, too, that this idea of human specialness and privilege implies a split or separation between humans and the rest of the natural world, and that this split has resulted in a variety of ecological, societal, philosophical, and personal crises, all because of the particular story we tell ourselves about the relationship between humans and the rest of nature, between consciousness and the physical world. It is a story or worldview called materialism. Materialism tells us that the fundamental nature of reality is purely physical, or matter, material. All that exists can be explained ultimately in terms of the mechanics and dynamics of matter or energy, and that includes consciousness. Consciousness, we are told, is merely an emergent byproduct of electrochemical processes in the brain. It's as if consciousness is nothing more than a kind of electronic glow or luminescence dancing between the billions of synapses in our brains. As if consciousness was the biological counterpart of the blue-gray glow on your computer monitor or the hum of your hard drive. Philosophically, this position is deeply problematic. It misses entirely the most crucial characteristic of consciousness, namely its subjectivity. To repeat, the problem is this: how is it possible that wholly physical, objective brains could ever produce something that is neither physical or objective? How, in other words, can we get subjective experience from purely physical objects such as brains and nervous systems? No materialist has ever been able to answer this. Instead, we are asked to accept the story of materialism on faith. We are asked to accept that it is obvious that minds emerge from brains, even if no one has the slightest idea how this could happen. But such emergence was and remains nothing more than an act of faith, and an act of faith that implies acceptance of a miracle. We are asked to have faith in materialism that one day, when all the facts are in, when neuroscience has progressed sufficiently to understand the intricacies of the brain, then we will know the mechanics involved in how the brain produces consciousness. But this, we saw, amounts to nothing more than promissory materialism, and does not come close to meeting the criteria of scientific knowledge. In fact, it is nothing more than a metaphysical prejudice masquerading as science. Materialism is a story based on a metaphysical assumption that the ultimate nature of reality is purely physical. It is just a metaphysical assumption. But as we've seen, it is a bankrupt metaphysical position. As soon as we try to account for mind in the cosmos, for the fact that the universe includes consciousness, materialism draws a blank. Given the worldview of materialism, consciousness poses an apparently insurmountable problem for both science and philosophy. As we've seen, in philosophy, the problem is how to account for subjectivity in an otherwise objective universe, how to explain the ontological jump from a wholly objective state of reality, the state of the cosmos before any minds evolved or emerged, and an utterly different state of reality where subjectivity, experience, and interiority now exist. No one has even come close to explaining how this could be possible, how, as one philosopher put it, we could get the wine of consciousness from the water of the brain without a miracle. Such an ontological jump would indeed require a supernatural intervention, a miracle. And since miracles have no place in philosophy, the story of materialist emergence self-implodes under the weight of a profound metaphysical contradiction. In science, the problem is equally severe, for similar and related reasons. Science, we know, works by observation and measurement of objective things and events. But there is no way to objectively observe or measure consciousness. Science deals with objects in space, and consciousness is notoriously not located anywhere in space. Science gains knowledge by understanding mechanisms, but no mechanism explains consciousness. So, when it comes to mind or consciousness, both science and philosophy face a profound crisis, and the crisis is called the hard problem. Besides materialism, we explored three other worldviews or ontologies that have attempted to solve the hard problem. These are dualism, idealism, and panpsychism. Let's recap. The problem for materialism is to account for the emergence of mind from wholly mindless matter without invoking a miracle. It's the problem of emergence. For dualism, the problem is to explain how two utterly different and separate kinds of reality, mind and matter, could ever interact. Again, such interaction would require a miracle. For idealism, the problem is twofold, depending on the brand of idealism. For Maya idealism, the problem shows up as a performative contradiction. When an idealist claims that matter is an illusion, Maya means illusion in Hindu, when an idealist claims that matter is an illusion, yet that person lives or performs in the world in a way that contradicts that claim, we would say he or she doesn't walk the talk. That's the performative, pragmatic contradiction. For the other kind of idealism, emanationist idealism, the problem is logically the same as it is for materialism, though now in reverse. An emanationist says the cosmos begins with pure spirit and then, through a series of step-down constraints, becomes more and more dense until it turns into real, dense matter. But how can you get real matter out of wholly matterless spirit or consciousness? Again, this would require a miracle. Which leaves us with a fourth alternative, panpsychism. This worldview acknowledges the reality of both matter and mind, and that neither one has ontological priority over the other. In other words, neither matter nor mind gives rise to or can be reduced to the other. Furthermore, because panpsychism does not assume any separation between mind and matter, it does not require a miracle to account for their interaction. And because it takes the view that consciousness goes all the way down, it doesn't have to account for the emergence of mind from mindless matter. And nor does it involve a performative contradiction, because it doesn't claim that matter is an illusion. And because it doesn't put pure consciousness or spirit at the starting gate, it doesn't face the difficulties of emanationism, of explaining how we could get real matter from purely matterless spirit. So panpsychism seems the most likely story to account for the fact that we live in a universe with real matter and real mind, because it doesn't require a miracle. It sees both matter and mind as natural, requiring no supernatural intervention of any kind. As an alternative to materialism, panpsychism is preferable not only because it fits the facts much better, but also because its implications for our ecology, society, personal lives, for science, and for philosophical integrity are so much more appealing. And because panpsychism takes the view that matter itself is intrinsically sentient, that consciousness goes all the way down, it means that all of nature, from highly evolved creatures with complex brains to the simplest single-celled organisms and further, that all of these tingle with the spark of spirit. From the perspective of panpsychism, nature and cosmos are suffused with mind and consciousness. Literally, nature has a mind of its own, and so does the cosmos. We call this cosmic mind or cosmic eye by the name God. And like matter and mind, God is naturalized. God, from this view, is no longer seeing as supernatural. So looking out on the world through the eyes of panpsychism, we see and experience a world teeming with consciousness, with sentient beings, all the way up and all the way down. We see a sacred world, a world permeated with soul and spirit, a divine world worthy of our deepest respect and awe. And when we see and live in the world with such eyes, we begin to relate to nature differently. If we do so in time, we may yet avoid earth crash and be around to share in the magnificent unfolding of earth spirit. With panpsychism, or radical naturalism as I call it, we can begin to tell ourselves a new story, a different cosmology. And this new story, we have seen, is actually a very old story, told for countless millennia by indigenous cultures around the world. If we urbanized moderns begin to tell ourselves this different story and begin to benefit from living more sustainable lifestyles, we will have a new and ancient guiding philosophy. We will have a philosophy that heals the mind-body and human nature split. A philosophy that accounts for the presence of consciousness in an otherwise physical universe. But we will still face the problem of developing a science of mind, a science of consciousness. So far, modern science has been highly successful in exploring the nature and dynamics of matter, of the physical universe, but has not been able to even begin a comparable study of the nature and dynamics of mind or consciousness. And we saw why this is so. The standard scientific method works exclusively with observable and measurable objective entities. Yet consciousness is none of these. Consciousness is neither observable with the senses nor any of the instruments developed by us to extend the senses. It's not measurable in any way, it's not objective, and it's not quantifiable. Science works only with objects and events in space. Consciousness does not exist in space. So anyone interested in developing a science of consciousness faces a profound dilemma. Either we need to radically change the way science is done by including different modes of inquiry, or we have to give up the hope of ever having a science of consciousness. Expressed this way, the dilemma reveals its own solution. Clearly, if we do want a science of consciousness, then science has to radically change. Of all the categories of study and investigation, consciousness is unique. In all other fields of inquiry, it is possible, at least in theory, to assume a separation between the subject doing the inquiry and the object under investigation. However, when consciousness is the focus of study, such separation is no longer an option, because now the subject itself becomes its own object. The beam of inquiry is turned back on the very instrument of inquiry itself. So we have no option but to explore consciousness using consciousness. As we saw, plate glass science will not work for investigating mind. We can no longer assume a separation between subject and object, between the knower and the known. Instead, to study consciousness, we will need a new kind of science, looking glass science, where the beam of inquiry is reflected back on itself. Let's briefly revisit the different criteria for plate glass science and looking glass science. Plate glass science deals with subjectivity, measurement and quantity, mechanism, prediction, control, where the deep motivation is fear. Looking glass science, by contrast, instead of objectivity, has subjectivity. Instead of measurement and quantity, has engagement and quality. Instead of mechanism, has meaning. Instead of prediction, has growth. Instead of control, has transformation. And instead of a deep motivation of fear, the deep motivation is trust. Besides the need for new criteria for science and different methodologies for doing science, we saw that we will also need to come up with new ways of talking about consciousness. Standard scientific language draws heavily on mechanistic metaphors and descriptions, based for the most part on our own dominant senses of vision and touch. We know our way around the physical world by relying greatly on what we can see and feel. A great deal of scientific evidence relies on the old maxim, seeing is believing. And if you can't see it, then touch it. And failing that, at least measure it. Again, we cannot see, touch, or measure consciousness. It just doesn't exist in the universe in the way that physical objects do. Consciousness has a different kind of existence. First, as we've seen, it is not an object. Consciousness is the subject that studies or knows any object. Consciousness has no extension in space. It cannot be measured. It is neither big nor small, heavy nor light, bright or dark, bitter or sweet, perfumed or pungent, loud or silent, except in some metaphorical sense. Because of this, we saw that energy talk is inappropriate for discussing consciousness. Mind cannot be reduced to the language of mechanism, which is a description of energy exchanges between physical objects in space. Mechanism is a description of exchanges of energy between physical objects in space. Yet our habits of thought, based on our dominant senses of vision and touch, keep pulling us back to energy talk, even when it is inappropriate, and energy talk is mechanistic talk. Our task, then, is to find ways of breaking these deeply ingrained linguistic and conceptual habits. In exploring consciousness, we need to give up energy talk and the search for mechanisms, and instead flex our mental metaphors based in consciousness talk, replacing the search for mechanism by a search for meaning. Because consciousness does not exist in space, it does not work by transference of energy from one location to another. It does not work, in other words, by mechanism. Instead, consciousness works by sharing or participating in meanings. Instead of words such as energy, vibrations, waves, feels, mechanism, non-local, and so on, to describe consciousness and how it works, we need to make use of more appropriate terminology for consciousness, such as meaning, purpose, intention, attention, feeling, choice, desire, empathy, compassion, altruism, curiosity, experience, knowledge, wisdom, pleasure, satisfaction, understanding, hope, faith, certainty, honesty, integrity, love, as well as less savory aspects of consciousness such as pain, anger, hate, fear, grief, dishonesty, ignorance, pride, laziness, selfishness, greed, and loneliness, none of which can be reduced to explanations in terms of physical mechanisms. That's consciousness talk. Because consciousness doesn't exist in space, it is not a form of energy, and therefore cannot be accurately described using energy talk. And because consciousness does not exist in space, it means that when we talk of mind in the cosmos, we mean that mind is in the cosmos in a way different from the way suns or galaxies are in the cosmos, or the way a brain is inside a skull. Consciousness exists in brains, and mind exists in the cosmos in the same way a feeling exists in your body. For example, the way a taste of chocolate or a toothache exists in your body. The experience of the taste or the pain is real, but it cannot be located anywhere in your body. Open up a decayed tooth, for example, and you will never locate the pain. You can only feel it. Open up a brain, and you will never locate the taste of chocolate. You can only experience it. In the same way, mind is not located in the cosmos. It is felt in the cosmos. It is the capacity that the cosmos and any of its constituents has for feeling. Mind is not in the cosmos so much as it is an ingredient of the cosmos. Think of it this way. The shape of a tennis ball is not in the substance of the ball, yet the shape is inseparable from the substance. Analogously, mind is not in the cosmos, and consciousness is not in matter, yet mind is inseparable from matter. Matter tingles with consciousness, cosmos tingles with mind. So if mind is not in space, then how can science ever study it? Well, one answer we already looked at is that what we call science will have to radically change to become a database not just of quantities, but also of qualities, or qualia. And science will have to complement its historical reliance on mechanism and energy talk with an openness to meaning and mind talk. This does not mean that nothing in the vast database of modern scientific knowledge, from quantum physics, neuroscience, cognitive science, psychology, to anthropology, can help in the studies in the study of consciousness. These sciences can be a great source of knowledge about the correlates of consciousness, such as what goes on in the brain. But we just need to keep in mind that knowledge of brain events is not the same as knowledge of mind events. Brain does not equal mind. Studies of the brain are third-person explorations of objects in space, and these may very well be useful for telling us what is going on in the matter of the brain while its owner is having a particular experience. But the experience per se is not in the brain, and therefore cannot be an object for neuroscientific study. To study the experience, we need a different approach, a first-person approach. The subject having the experience needs to observe internally, through meditation or introspection, what it feels like to be having that experience. This approach leads to a very different scientific database, a database containing first-person experiential data, second-person reported data, as well as conventional third-person data about the correlates of consciousness. Instead of an exclusive reliance on sensory empiricism, where the only acceptable data are those gathered via the senses, for example through vision and touch, the new science will adopt what philosopher-psychologist William James called radical empiricism. In radical empiricism, all data show up in experience, whether or not through a sensory channel, that all data that show up in experience are valid for scientific knowledge, and only data that show up in experience are valid. Such a science is the only way forward for a true science of consciousness. It is what we call noetic science. Noetic sciences are explorations into the nature and potentials of consciousness using multiple ways of knowing, including intuition, feeling, reason, and the senses. Noetic sciences explore the inner cosmos of the mind, that is consciousness, soul, or spirit, and how it relates to the outer cosmos of the physical world. A comprehensive science of consciousness would include 1. First-person perspective by supporting individuals to explore and develop their own subject of consciousness, for example, in meditation and other spiritual practices. Here, the emphasis is on inner knowing and personal transformation. 2. Through the second-person perspective, by exploring and supporting transformative relationships and intersubjective consciousness, for example, compassionate dialogue, community building, a global wisdom society. Here, the emphasis is on transformative learning and collective wisdom. 3. The third-person perspective, by gathering data about objective physiological correlates of consciousness, for example, research using rigorous scientific protocols, including experiments in neuroscience, cognitive science, psi, mind-body healing, and subtle energies. Here, the emphasis is on scientific understanding. These three are the complementary elements of a noetic science. All three perspectives value and employ multiple ways of knowing, including intuition, reason, and the senses, in varying combinations. Besides advances in neuroscience, many people are excited by discoveries and implications of quantum physics, and believe that perhaps, here at last, we have a science that will be an open sesame to consciousness. But can we expect quantum physics to bridge the gap between third-person objective science and first-person subjective science? Well, for reasons I've already outlined, I don't think we should get too excited about quantum physics as a source of knowledge that might enlighten us about consciousness. quantum physics is still exclusively the study of third-person objective entities. Even though the observer's consciousness seems to be implicated in the collapse of the quantum wave function, the data of physics are all exclusively objective and quantifiable. No matter how bizarre, counterintuitive, or paradigm-breaking the data of quantum physics may be, and no matter how deep into the structure of the physical world this science takes us, it is still all within the physical, objective domain. Quantum physics is a third-person science. It studies objective events and therefore does not inform us about first-person, subjective events. In short, quantum physics does not tell us about consciousness. However, quantum physics may still be a useful source of metaphors for understanding some aspects of consciousness, even if it cannot provide mechanisms for understanding consciousness. And as we saw in an earlier lecture, quantum theory may provide an opening into consciousness studies if we radically shift its metaphysical basis from materialism to some form of idealism or panpsychism. For instance, we saw that psychologist Carl Jung found useful metaphors in quantum physics, particularly in relation to the phenomenon of synchronicity. Other consciousness theorists found insightful metaphors for consciousness in the ideas of wave-particle duality, where consciousness or awareness in general is likened to a wave, and specific thoughts or habits are compared with particles. When viewed through the lens of the quantum, the deep roots of the physical world, subatomic particles, quarks or quanta, or superstrings, evaporate into ghostly swirls and patterns of energy that behave nothing like matter as we know it. Quantum physics, then, reveals the deep foundations of physical reality to be very immaterial, indeed, even seemingly non-physical. And we may be excused, therefore, for expecting that quantum physics, because it deals with elusive ghostly entities, may yet get us to consciousness. One great physicist even remarked that the universe begins to look less and less like a great machine and more like a great thought. And coupling the world of the micro in quantum physics with the world of the macro in cosmology, we might even be excused for thinking that some kind of quantum cosmology might yet lead us to mind in the cosmos, helping to bridge the perennial gap between the two cultures of science and spirit. And indeed, this may be so. But again, only if we embrace a radically different metaphysical foundation for both the quantum and the cosmos. We looked at three quantum cosmologies that did just this. We looked at Amit Goswami's idealist quantum physics and the idea of science within consciousness. We looked at David Bohm's implicate order and its practical application in human relations through the practice of dialogue. And we looked at Arthur Young's theory of process and reflexive model, where the quantum is consciousness and spirit, and where the physicist's photon is identical to the mystic's divine light. Let's look at each of these a little bit more in brief detail. Amit Goswami takes a radically idealist approach to quantum physics and science, and science in general, by shifting to a foundational metaphysical assumption where consciousness is the ultimate reality. It is a form of emanationist idealism. Instead of deriving consciousness from the quantum, as many more mainstream quantum theorists have attempted to do, Goswami derives the quantum from consciousness. He proposes that all the apparent paradoxes encountered in the quantum domain can be resolved by the simple maneuver of positing consciousness as primary. Consciousness, he says, begins by objectifying itself, by becoming self-aware, thereby creating a duality of subject and object. This, he says, is the starting point for all manifest reality, and it shows up as the phenomenon of quantum entanglement that underlies the entire structure of the physical world. So, for Goswami, the sequence of manifestation is as follows. Consciousness leading to the quantum leading to the physical world. And one fascinating aspect of Goswami's thesis is what it implies for time and evolution. According to his model, self-awareness or reflexive consciousness is necessary for the creation of the quantum world, and therefore for all physical manifestation that follows from the quantum. In other words, only when the first living creature achieved self-awareness did time and evolution come into being. For Goswami, this happened with the appearance of the first living cell. But this presents a problem. You might wonder, how could time and evolution depend on the appearance of the first living cell if the cell itself had to evolve? Where, in other words, did the first living cell come from? We know from cosmology that the universe existed for billions of years before the appearance of living cells, yet according to Goswami, there could have been no universe prior to the self-awareness of the first living cell. Now, this seems to be a fatal paradox or flaw in Goswami's model. But Goswami has an answer, albeit a mind-boggling answer. Drawing on his knowledge of quantum physics, Goswami proposes that all the events in the cosmos, from the Big Bang onwards, the entire panorama of cosmic evolution for 15 or so billion years, all of this existed in potential. Before the first living cell, all of physical reality, including the Big Bang and all that followed, existed as quantum probabilities, a spectrum of superimposed alternative realities lying in a kind of suspended animation until one of those probabilities manifested as the first living cell. At that moment, at the birth of the first living cell, the entire history of life and the cosmos, all the unfoldings of cosmic, chemical, and biological evolution came into being, from potentia to actuality in an instant. It's as if nothing existed in manifest reality, and then, poof, the first living cell popped into being, trailing its own entire evolution from the Big Bang onwards. This is indeed a mind-boggling, a challenging theory of the universe. And I encourage you to read Goswami's The Self-Aware Universe for his own account of this process. Again, as I said, it is a mind-boggling scenario. Whether or not you accept it depends on whether you feel comfortable with the idea of a living cell being able to evolve in the domain of quantum probabilities, a domain where there is no time. How could anything evolve, even in quantum potential, without time? What does evolution mean without time? However, you may be willing to suspend such questions if one of the payoffs is a model that otherwise offers you a way to solve a host of other mind-boggling paradoxes in quantum physics. And that's what Goswami's model does offer. Now, you would be substituting one mind-boggle for another. And perhaps, when it comes to deep metaphysical issues such as the origin of the universe, the relationship between consciousness and the physical world, some mind-boggling mystery will inevitably remain. Amit Goswami offers one way of using quantum physics to enlighten us about consciousness. But, of course, as an idealist, he does so by assuming that consciousness already pre-exists quantum reality and the physical world. For Goswami, consciousness is the source of the quantum, not the other way around. David Bohm, also a quantum physicist, takes a different approach. Instead of positing consciousness as primary, Bohm points to a reality deeper than the quantum, a reality he calls the implicate order. According to Bohm, what we know as quantum reality emerges from this deeper, enfolded, implicate reality. And what we know as mind or consciousness has its origins there too. Bohm tells us that both manifest subject, mind or consciousness, and manifest substance, matter or energy, arise out of a common, deeper, unmanifest reality. Bohm avoids any miraculous supernatural intervention to account for the emergence of mind and matter from a mindless, matterless implicate order. He tells us that the implicate order itself possesses a kind of intelligence or mind, as well as a kind of universal source of potential energy, sometimes referred to as the zero-point energy field. So, in Bohm's cosmology, as in panpsychism, something like mind and matter already exist in the deep structure of the implicate order. Again, like Goswami, he is not proposing that quantum physics can lead us to an understanding of how the physical world generates consciousness. Instead, he tells us that mind or consciousness was there right from the start, along with some form of matter energy. In other words, the quantum, and therefore the cosmos, already comes with some degree of intelligence, mind, or consciousness. Although a highly respected quantum physicist, David Bohm's life work was concerned more with the ethical implications of his physics than merely with abstract theoretical knowledge about the quantum. He was deeply concerned about the fragmentation he saw in the world, in science, in society, in our personal lives, in our habits of thought. And he used his knowledge of quantum physics and cosmology to develop a way of exploring the sources of such widespread fragmentation. Bohm was passionate about wholeness in all aspects of life. And to find out more, I encourage you to read his book, Wholeness and the Implicate Order. Both Goswami and Bohm used the knowledge of quantum theory to throw light on the question of mind in the cosmos. But they did so by rejecting the standard foundational metaphysical assumption of materialism, and instead proposed versions of quantum physics informed, on the one hand, by idealist philosophy, and on the other, by an insight compatible with panpsychism. And that brings us to our third and final cosmology of consciousness. Although he was a mathematician and an engineer by training, and not a professional quantum physicist, Arthur M. Young spent much of his intellectual life studying and teaching about the quantum. We have explored his ideas in some depth in this course, so here we will just highlight some of the key points of his theory of process. As we saw, the central idea in Young's model is that the quantum is consciousness. Unlike Goswami, Young doesn't give consciousness priority over the quantum, and unlike Bohm, he doesn't look for a reality deeper than the quantum. With all its profound mysteries, the quantum, or the photon, is sufficient, says Young, to account for all we know about consciousness and the physical world. So for Young, the cosmos begins when pure, absolutely free and unconstrained spirit or consciousness, the original quantum of action, chooses to constrain itself. Each constraint equals a dimension of manifest reality. The first constraint creates the single dimension of time. The second constraint creates the two dimensions of space. The third dimension of space we call depth is, according to Young, really the dimension of time. And the third constraint creates the three-dimensional world of space-time objects, the manifest world of matter. Young's comprehensive theory offers a way to bridge the gap between science and spirit. By making the quantum the ultimate fundamental, he makes a case that the physicist's photon is identical to the mystic's divine light. The mysterious properties of light, he says, hold the clues to uniting the discoveries of physics with the insights of mysticism. We saw that Jung's model is based on the structure and dynamics of the reflexive arc. Beginning with the dimensionless photon, the cosmos comes into being by moving through four levels in seven stages. The four levels are level one, spirit, quantum, photon, level two, time, soul, nuclear forces, emotions, level three, space, atoms, egoic minds, reason, level four, time-space, molecules, and matter. The seven stages move through the four levels via the fourfold cosmic process of involution, turn, evolution, and return. The three stages of involution are stage one, spirit, quantum, photon, stage two, time, soul, nuclear forces, stage three, space, atoms, then encountering the turn at stage four, time, space, molecules, and matter. At that point, then, beginning the ascent of evolution at stage five with life and cells, leading to stage six, the level of mind, self-reflective consciousness, ultimately back to stage seven, to spirit, the quantum, the photon. So the fourfold process of involution, turn, evolution, and return. Besides laying out a theory of the cosmos, Jung's model also includes a comprehensive epistemology, different ways of knowing the different levels of reality. We can know level one, the level of spirit, only through spiritual intuition, the domain of the mystic, of direct mystical experience. We know level two, the level of the soul and time, only through non-sensory, non-rational feeling, the domain of the shaman. And we can know level three, the level of space and mind, through reasoning, the domain of the philosopher. And we can know level four, the level of time-space or space-time, through the senses, the domain of the scientist. Recognizing that different levels of reality require different ways of knowing, we see why a purely scientific, materialist, rational understanding of the world cannot reveal the full story about reality. Even if we reject the idea of levels of reality, it is still clear that a purely sense-based, rational investigation of the cosmos cannot comprehend all of reality. The very fact that consciousness exists, as we've seen, already rules out our standard scientific methodology. If we wish to have a science of consciousness, it is clear that the only option is for science to undergo a profound transformation. Scientific methodology must change to include non-sensory ways of knowing. And once we open up to extrasensory ways of knowing, once we pay attention to our actual experience of consciousness, we soon realize that there are at least two fundamentally different modes of consciousness. In an earlier lecture, we identified these as pre-conquest consciousness and post-conquest consciousness. Pre-conquest consciousness refers to the feeling-based mode of awareness common to indigenous peoples throughout the world. It is deeply relational and dialogical. It's a form of consciousness still anchored to its roots in the body. It approaches truth by finding out what feels good for the community. Contrasted with this, modern post-conquest consciousness is reason-based, conceptual, and dialectical. It aims to arrive at knowledge by a process of conflict, pitching one truth against another in the hope of arriving at a higher synthesis. We saw that when these two modes of consciousness encounter each other, reason-based conquest consciousness inevitably decimates feeling-based pre-conquest consciousness, even if it didn't intend to. However, we saw too that this is true only if we assume a monolithic approach to reason and a truncated view of the evolution of consciousness. First, post-conquest reason would wipe out pre-conquest feeling only if reason were the end game in the evolution of consciousness. But we know that is not the case. Spiritual literature is full of accounts of people who have transcended reason in mystical experiences. And unlike dialectical reasoning, mystical knowing does not develop only at the expense of reason. Mystical experience does not operate by domination the way reason does. Rather, mystical experience embraces the best that reason can offer while then going beyond it. Mystical experience includes and transcends reason. Second, we need to identify two kinds of reason. Clear or embodied reason, on the one hand, and distorting or abstract reason, on the other. Clear or embodied reason refers to a mode of thinking that remains in touch with its source in the feelings of the body. It is a mode of reason informed by the body's innate wisdom, and so remains connected not only to our own bodies, but to the greater body of the world around us, earth and cosmos. We describe this as feeling our thinking. On the other hand, distorting or abstract reason refers to a mode of thinking that relies on following the twists and turns of logic through various circuits of abstract thoughts or concepts. It has lost contact with its roots in the body. Instead of being informed by the natural wisdom of embodiment, this kind of reason tends to get short-circuited in abstractions, a process of hooking together a series of thoughts to see if they fit coherently. This mode of abstract reasoning, typical of most modern philosophy, science, commerce, often turns out to be dysfunctional because, as David Bohm taught, it focuses on fragmentation, on analysis, on isolated ideas or truths. As long as reason is confined to conceptual abstractions, it cannot arrive at wholeness or wisdom. Instead of feeling our thinking, we merely think our thinking by stringing thoughts together. It is actually a mode of thinking that has lost contact with the multifaceted nature of reality. And this kind of reason does suppress, invalidate, diminish, or destroy feeling-based pre-conquest consciousness. But reason per se doesn't have to decimate feeling. If we open up to feeling our thinking by paying attention to how ideas well up from feelings inside our bodies, we then open the way for a kind of reason that honors feeling, resulting in a more holistic mode of knowing. In identifying the two modes of consciousness, pre- and post-conquest, we saw how they achieve quite different ends. Which end we choose will depend on our motivation for exploration and communication. Are we ultimately interested in truth at all costs? Or in wisdom for the sake of all? This question is particularly relevant when exploring consciousness itself. And if, as my research suggests, consciousness is ultimately relational and intersubjective, then we are unlikely ever to make much progress by aiming for truth at all costs. Such a post-conquest approach is inimical to relationship and ends up fragmenting consciousness. Mere truth without wisdom will at best yield abstract knowledge about consciousness, but will not give us direct understanding of consciousness as it is actually experienced. And the issue of truth or wisdom is also relevant to the question of mind in the cosmos. We have covered a lot of ground since our first lecture 10 sessions ago. Our goal has been to explore the idea of mind in the cosmos and the evolution of consciousness. By now, I hope, it is clear that we can explore mind or consciousness only by opening our explorations to other ways of knowing. We simply cannot ever capture consciousness in a net of language or abstract ideas. If we want to know about mind in the cosmos, we need to learn to feel our thinking, to open up to other extra-rational and extrasensory ways of knowing. And often, the most effective medium for such knowing is through silence. Now that we have read the assigned books and other supplemental texts, communicated back and forth via email, and digested countless ideas about mind or consciousness and its role in the cosmos, now it is time to let it all go. Now it is time to let words and ideas drift away and instead fall into silence, paying attention to the feelings coursing through our bodies. What messages do they bring? Where do those messages come from? My parting words to you are these. Listen. Listen to the wisdom of your body. Listen to the messages it conveys from the world around you. Listen to discover your place in the cosmos. Listen and feel the simple, undeniable certainty of mind in the cosmos. Listen and feel the power and the wisdom of silence. Thank you for taking this journey with me into exploring the evolution of consciousness and mind in the cosmos.